Today is the sixth day of our September-October seven-day session at Chapin Mill. It's the 5th of October 2018. And this morning we're going to take up a story from a volume called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. This is one of a series of talks based on this book and other sources that are an ongoing attempt to get to know some of our female forebears. In Auckland now, we have a chant that we do based on one that was developed in Sweden about 10 or more years ago now, called the Pool of Radiance. We've kept the same name. And it starts off with Zen Tetsu Philip Kaplow, and it goes backwards through Japanese names, Chinese names, Indian names, and then goes back even beyond the primordial Buddhas to Mahaprajnaparamita, the mother of all Buddhas. And it includes both the names of many of the women that we now know about from Zen history as they've been uncovered in the last 10 or 20 years, but also names of some of the male masters that we're familiar with from the koan collections but who don't appear in our particular ancestral line. And this Pool of Radiance chant sits alongside our ancestral line. We still chant both the short and the long ancestral line, and that's important. That's our family tree. But now alongside that chant, those chants, we also do this Pool of Radiance. It has 108 names in it. But in starting to do this chant, we realized that we were quite unfamiliar with a lot of the names that we are there. And actually that revealed how there are a lot of names in our regular ancestor line that we don't know anything about the background of the names we chant, the people we chant about. So we've also started looking into those. So it's quite a long process because it's going to take, there are a lot of names and it's going to take a long time to get to all of them. And we haven't been doing the Pool of Radiance names in order, just sort of haphazardly looking into some of these stories here and there. And this book, The Hidden Lamp, has been a great resource for that. It's a gathering together of 100 stories and drawing on about women in our history, both within the Zen school and beyond, basing it on a lot of different bits of scholarship, bringing those together and putting it into a very accessible form. The editors sometimes refer to the stories as koans, and although some of them fit that description, some are more just straight teaching stories, not so koan-like. Each story also has a commentary by a contemporary female teacher. Again, not only from Zen, though most of them probably are, but from other traditions as well. And this morning we'll be looking at the commentary that goes with our story as well. And the title of this morning's story is Chiyono's No Water, No Moon. And this comes from 13th century Japan. And I'll just read the entire story first, and then we'll look at some biographical material on this Chiyono. Chiono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice Zazen. One day she approached an elderly nun and asked, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha even though I have no skills?" The nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen." Chiono said with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life, practicing day and night." After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightenment poem was this: "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell." So that's our story. There's a little bit of biographical material in the back of the book. Chiono, and it dates are 1223 to 1298, so she's 23 years younger than Dogen, so the same century. Chiono was the first Japanese woman whose enlightenment was recognized and who received transmission in a Zen lineage from Chinese master Wu Shui Zuyuan. In one version of her story, she was said to be the daughter of a high-ranking family, but was employed as a servant in a Zen convent in Hiromi in Mino province. She founded several convents in Kyoto, including Keiji, the leading women's monastery in Japan's medieval period. Chiono was her secular name. Her Dharma name was Mugai Nyodai or Mujaku Nyodai. There are many versions of her life story, and it does get a bit complicated when you look into it, because some of these versions are quite divergent. For this talk, I just had access to a couple of other texts, so it's a little bit hard to try and discern what might be the actual story, and perhaps impossible, even if I did have access to more material. But we'll just look a little bit more into some of the details of her life before we go back to our story. So it says here in the back of the book that she was said to be the daughter of a high-ranking family, but was employed as a servant in a Zen convent. Actually, it's probably more likely that she was doing this water-carrying work, not as a servant in the narrow sense, but as part of her novice period, because she did ordain as a nun, and as a novice she would be expected to undertake this kind of work. So if we go with the versions of the story that say she was from a high-ranking family, then that family was a samurai family, and her father's name was Adachi Yasumori. And being the daughter of a samurai family, she received an education in poetry, music, classics, and Chinese. She was able to both write and speak Chinese. And this was to be very important because her teacher was a Chinese master. And at this time in Japan, there was quite a lot of coming and going between Japan and China, with monks such as Dogen going to train in China, and also Chinese monks coming to Japan. Chiyono married into the Kanezawa clan, and she and her husband had a daughter. Then in 1277, her husband died, and there are different accounts of how he died. Some say in battle, others that it was when he was in the service to his lord, traveling in terrible weather as a messenger and falling sick on this journey and dying. It's not clear when Chiyono took up Zen practice, whether it was before or after her husband died. But she studied under one Japanese master called Eni Bennen at Tofukuji, which was a big Rinzai monastery, and then also under the Chinese master Wu Sui Zhu Yuan. And there's a recording of an exchange between her and this Wu Sui, and this would have been conducted in Chinese. This is kind of a classic opening question for a student to a master. Chiyono asked, "What is Zen?" And Wu Shui said, "Zen is the heart of the one who asks, not somebody else's words." Zen is the heart of the one who asks. But then Chiyono came back and said, "So why does the teacher give sermons that are recorded?" And in those days, his teacher's talks, teishos, would be written down and circulated to students. This is a pretty bold question. Okay, you say it's not in other people's words, but why do you teach then? Why do you give teisho? And then Wu Shui replied, "With a deaf person, you show them the moon by pointing. With a blind person, you show them the gate by knocking on it." And then after a pause, he added, "When I was awakened, it was like a bird escaping a cage." This is quite a lot to this answer by Wu Shui. In referring to people who are deaf or blind, it's his way of talking about people who haven't encountered the Dharma. and using different methods to communicate with these people. He's talking here about upaya, or skillful means. Although it's true that the truth isn't other people's words, still this is the only way we have of indicating the Dharma. Teaching. Or at least it's not the only way, because there are certainly masters who did not use words. There was the master who, every time somebody came in and asked him about the Dharma, he would simply turn and face the wall. That was his teaching. Ugute, who would hold up one finger. You can think of many examples. But most of these masters also used words. And Wushui here uses this image, this very frequently used image of pointing, using a finger to point at the moon. And the reminder was being that don't confuse the moon of enlightenment with the finger pointing at it. And of course, if you actually tried to, if you had a rocket, and you tried to get to the moon just based on that pointing finger, you'd likely miss it. But then he adds this personal note. When I was awakened, it was like a bird escaping a cage. What he's saying here, in an indirect kind of way, is that the reason why he gives sermons, gives teishos, is because he wants others to experience what he experienced. He wants to let other birds out of their cages. Chiyono ordained in her 50s, quite late, probably after her husband had died, and she was given the name Mugai Nyodai, so Dharma name. And eventually Wu Shui recognized her as one of his two Dharma heirs. This was very unusual. In fact, she said to be the first woman in Japanese history to be sanctioned as a Rinzai master. And after this, she went on to found Kyaiji in Kyoto. She did this after the death of her father. Probably what that meant was she had some inheritance that she was able to use to build this temple, and later on it became the head temple of a network of 15 sub-temples, all of them associated with this head temple in Kyoto. And at some point in after she was ordained, almost all of her family were slaughtered in a particularly nasty bout of clan warfare. Almost all her relatives were killed, except for one uncle. It's also thought that she may have disfigured herself in order to be able to enter a monastery. And this story is told in a book called Zen Women by Grace Shiason. And this is an earlier book with stories of Zen women. That was one of the places that the authors of The Hidden Lamp turned to in choosing stories. And Grace Shiason relates that the story goes that Zen master Eni Bennin, so that's the Japanese master that she trained under before Wu Shui, that he was amenable to Chiyono training at his all-male monastery, but that his disciples caused a ruckus. Coming from a wealthy family, she then offered to sponsor the construction of a convent within the grounds of Tofukugiji, this big Rinzai monastery. And these places are huge. They have many temples within the temple. So she offered to build a special separate building for her and presumably other nuns to come and train under Eni Bennin. But this did not pacify the monks, who continued their harassment. Mugai then scarred her face with a hot iron. Her self-mutilation was a declaration of her sincerity and lack of interest in using feminine wiles. And the scholar who discovered this conjectures, this is somebody called Barbara Rook, she conjectures that one can see the burn when viewing a lifelike statue made in the image of Chiyono or Mugai Nyodai, evidenced by the droop of her right cheek. But in another version of the story, this is attributed to having had a stroke. So who knows? But this fact of her disfiguring herself by burning her face, apparently it was admired at the time as showing her great determination, and certainly we can admire her courage in doing something like this, but it's also evidence of the violence of a system that excluded women so completely and then persecuted them when they did try and participate. There's some evidence that she wasn't the only one who did this. And there is another story in The Hidden Lamp about a nun called Ryonin, who also was to do something similar. And this story comes from a few centuries later, so it may be that this Ryonin Genso was possibly influenced by this story from the 13th century. I'll just read this other account of the woman who burned herself. And just as a footnote to this, burning oneself has long been a part of Chinese Buddhism, and we can trace it back to accounts in the Lotus Sutra. And even Great Master Shu Yun, as we said the other day when we were reading from his teachings, he had burnt one finger as a kind of a sacrifice of dedicating the merit to his mother, who had died while giving birth to him. But here's this 17th century story. As a young woman, Ryonin Genso was an attendant to the Empress and was known for her beauty and intelligence. When the empress died, she felt the impermanence of life, and she decided to become a nun. Ronen travelled to the city of Edo in search of a Zen teacher. The first teacher refused her because of her beauty. Then she asked Master Hakuo Dotai, who also refused her. He could see her sincere intention, but he too said that her womanly appearance would cause problems for the monks in the monastery. Afterwards, she saw some women pressing fabric, and she took up a hot iron and held it against her face, scarring herself. Then she wrote this poem on the back of a small mirror. To serve my empress, I burned incense to perfume my exquisite clothes. Now, as a homeless mendicant, I burn my face to enter a Zen temple. The four seasons flow naturally like this. Who is this now in the midst of these changes? She returned to Hakuo and gave him the poem. Hakuo immediately accepted her as a disciple. She became the abbess of his temple when he died and later founded her own temple. Before her death, she wrote the following poem. This is the 66th autumn I have seen. The moon still lights my face. Don't ask me about the meaning of Zen teachings. Just listen to what the pines and cedars say on a windless night. Just a little bit more biographical material before we go back to our story. So not only did she face this resistance to her training, at the beginning of that training, but then also after she died, there were efforts to remove evidence of her being one of her teacher's Dharma successors. One of the people who was involved in this was Muso Soseki, that some people here may have heard mentioned in Taisho, and there's a little book of his teachings called Dream Conversations. And apparently he was one of the main movers behind this process, that he did not approve of Mugai Nyodai's transmission, and he did not accept that she was a true lineage holder. And so a lot of the records about her were destroyed, so that it took quite some work and was surprising to a scholar who was doing some research to suddenly find an image of obviously female master. So this removal from the history book, so to speak, is a particularly extreme example of what has happened to a lot of these women that we're now discovering, is that we may know a name or have a story or two, but very often the teachings weren't kept. They weren't considered to be important enough, and these teachers, these female teachers, weren't. Of course, in the lineages either, so they were sort of out on the edge of things, and the material that we have is quite haphazard and fragmented, and sometimes we don't even have a full name, just one name. So now back to our story. I'll just read it again and then say a little bit about it. Take it this time bit by bit. So in this version, she's a humble servant who can't read or write. But I think it's more likely that she was just doing the chores that any novice in a monastery would be assigned to do. This version we have with her makes the story a little bit more like that of Hui Neng, the sixth ancestor, the illiterate southerner who came to awakening without any learning. And sometimes it seems like these stories take sort of archetypal bits of Zen lore and stick them into these stories. So it's hard to know what actually happened. But in this version, she asks a nun about taking up Zen practice and attaining the way, and this also points to it being fictional, because as far as we know, at least Mugai Nyodai wasn't in a nunnery. She was practicing in a monastery, but we get this teaching, and it's good teaching. It's useful for us to hear. She makes some good points. First one is, she says, in Buddhism there are no distinctions between people. And if you look at the fundamental teaching, that's true. But just from what we've heard this morning, it's very clear that although that might have been the teaching, in the actual institutions, there certainly were distinctions. Discrimination. But if you go back to the teachings, it's certainly true that an illiterate servant can awaken. This nun says, "There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion." So she mentions here really the two wings of the bird of Buddhist practice: desire to awaken and developing a heart of compassion. She's talking here about bodhicitta, and there seem to be two aspects to bodhicitta: this aspiration to awaken in order to in order to help awaken others. And one aspect is waking up to the truth of emptiness. This is called ultimate bodhicitta, seeing into emptiness, seeing into our mind, the nature of the mind. But then there's also this other side, equally important, practicing compassion. This is relative bodhicitta, how bodhicitta unfolds in our relationships. In Sesshin, we're putting virtually all our energy into the first of these two, into this effort to see the nature of the mind directly, to experience it for ourselves. In everyday life, the emphasis is on the other wing of the bird. And we get this chance. Doesn't matter who it is, but whoever we encounter, the way we relate to that being is an opportunity to practice bodhicitta, to cultivate it. She goes on, "People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature." We so are enthralled by our thoughts that it is very hard for us to really appreciate this, that it's our thoughts which create distinctions such as Buddha and enlightened person or unenlightened person. In reality, these two are not separate things at all. But we divide up the world with our thoughts into enlightened and unenlightened, Buddha and sentient being. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen. This is a very helpful way of putting what we're doing. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. If this is the case, if this is true, then we don't have to be afraid of our delusive thoughts. They arise again and again. And if we can just follow those thoughts back to their source, then we'll know our true nature. So we practice right where the delusive thoughts arise. Don't have to get to some place first and then practice. So hearing this this teaching, Chiono realizes that she just has to put this into practice in her daily life, throughout her busy day of work. My guess is that she also sat. She might have been busy all day, but she would also be doing formal practice. Though it doesn't mention that here. The story says that after months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightened poem went like this. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. So we can imagine this this old bucket. These Japanese buckets, some people may have seen them. They're made up of staves of wood that are locked together, and then into a base. And then one of the staves is extended; it's longer, so that it gives a handle to the bucket. And then there's a kind of braided bamboo ring that holds all the staves together, or maybe more than one ring. A little bit like the metal bands that we have here in the Zendo on the pillars at the four corners, sort of like a barrel, the way a barrel is held together. And this bamboo bucket was pretty old and leaky, and had to be constantly kind of shored up. And then she has this experience of putting that bucket down into the river and pulling out the water, and then the whole thing collapses. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. So she notices that when there's no water in the bucket, then the image of the moon also disappears. She realizes here, things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. Person who gives a commentary on this particular story, it's very eloquent and it really speaks to this this story in ways I think that we can all relate to. Her name is Merle Kodo Boyd, and it's a little bit of biographical material on her. Merle Kodo Boyd is a Zen priest and teacher in the Miyazumi Glassman lineage and a member of the Zen Peacemaker community. She leads the Lincroft Zen Sangha in Monmouth County, New Jersey. Here's what she says. For several years now, I have kept a picture of Chiono and her bucket on the bulletin board above my desk. It is a delicate 19th century woodblock print of a young Chiono standing in pale moonlight, a bottomless bucket at her feet, a puddle of water spreading across the path. I was drawn to Chiono's verse the first time I heard it. I was seized by the words, "To this, with this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together." But I did not know that she was also thought to be Mugai Nyodai, whose name we chant in our morning dedication to our women ancestors. When I first heard Chiono's verse, I had been practicing for 10 or 12 years. I was cleanly aware of the constant tension of keeping the bucket together. I understood that the intent of practice was to relax my grip on the old bucket, but conditioning runs deep and the sense of personal identity is strong. Hearing the words, "with this and that," I felt the exhaustion of years of vigilance, all aimed at protecting my idea of myself. I felt the exhaustion of being my own obstacle. We can understand this bucket to be our the container we create for our sense of self. Our Zen practice is medicine to this conditioning. All the practices within Zen challenge the illusion of the perfect bucket. Zazen, the teacher-student relationship, rituals, sangha relationships. As much as I may wish to appear competent at all times, I cannot immerse myself in Zen practice without a willingness to come apart. Sometimes it's appropriate to stop patching things back together. What, then, allows us to leave the bits and pieces scattered on the ground, like the splinters of the bucket around Chiono's feet? I think especially here of Doksan, of being willing to have things fall apart, to let down our armor and be vulnerable, just as we need to be vulnerable in relation to the practice itself. We are conditioned to keep the bucket from falling to pieces. Unique personal circumstances can intensify this general conditioning. I was in the first generation of Southern black children consciously raised to enter integrated schools. In such circumstances, everything seems to ride on keeping it together, especially in public, and so we were conscientious and hypervigilant in order to prevent disaster. And yet, we Zen students have chosen a path that calls us in the opposite direction. In spite of our conditioning, we are called to awareness rather than vigilance. I think this is vigilance understood as a kind of defensive, anxious posture. We are on a path of no water, no moon. Our conditioning tells us that it is a risky path, and yet we sense its offer of freedom and feel called to take it. Ironically, it was precisely that conditioning of keeping it all together that gave me the courage to walk into a Zen center for the first time. I had been trained to tolerate the circumstance of being other, to maintain a public identity in places where I was allowed but possibly not welcome. Like the schools and libraries of my childhood, Zen centers offered something that I deeply needed, a place to experience my life in the world more deeply. I hoped I would be welcome at a Zen center, and I also knew that it could be otherwise. To walk into this uncertainty, I relied on being outwardly upright while keenly aware of inner fears. This was her holding it all together. As Zen students, we live between Chiono's first two lines and her second two lines, between keeping things from falling apart and letting them fall apart. Knowing how to keep things together is a valuable skill. It was knowing how to care for things that led Chiono to continually patch the bucket. When it fell apart, she made excellent use of that circumstance as well. Our liberation deepens with the refinement of our capacity for flexibility and discernment. We could see this as being in a psychological way, as we develop as human beings, forming a sense of self is a normal part of our growing up, so that we can function in the world and relate to other selves and set, to use a psychological term, healthy boundaries. But the problem, the big problem, is that we then identify so strongly with this convention that we have created. It comes from this illusion of the five skandhas of our mind and body. We imagine that we're separate in some fundamental kind of way. And because of this, we become less permeable, often even inflexible and defended, prejudiced about what is before us, what we experience, and that prejudice colours how we experience things. Merle Kyoto Boyd continues, "The liberation I was raised to seek is one aspect of the liberation we speak of in the Dharma. In the community of my childhood, our efforts were directed primarily towards gaining entrance into schools, access to employment, to housing, to services that made life more comfortable. But awareness of our essential and undeniable freedom comes with the awareness that we and all things are without self. The one who is liberated must be allowed to disappear like the water and the moon. Moving between patched bucket and bottomless bucket, I can exercise my freedom to keep things together or to let things come apart according to the circumstances. I have come to trust the true freedom of living where the moon does not dwell." And just to finish off with a verse, another verse that Chiyono Mugai Nyode wrote. This was later on, and it was addressed to her teacher as a way of expressing her enlightenment. She said, "Understanding nothing, I lost my way. But now I see that I too am one with the moon on the water and the floating clouds." So she, in her experience of the bottom dropping out of the bucket, she saw into there being no water and no moon. But this verse, she comes back from that. "Now I see I too am one with the moon on the water and the floating clouds." Not only is she one with the great, pure, round moon of enlightenment, with her true nature, she's also at peace with the floating clouds, the thoughts and feelings and experiences that pass across the face of that moon. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow